social media is a phenomenon that continues to grow and be the subject of much consternation, commentary, criticism, and scholarly research. Attempting to truly understand social media communication practices and tools requires interdisciplinary analysis and the examination of the technology from the varying perspectives of the groups of users, developers, and experts with respect to the issues surrounding it. It also should include and look at the changes social media has and continues to bring to various fields, particularly with respect to professional communication. Jeremy Lipschultz, Isaacson Professor in the School of Communication at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and frequent blogger for the Huffington Post and Chicago Now, is here on the show today to talk about the impact of social media on various mass communications professions, many of which he discusses in his new book, Social Media Communication: Concepts, Practices, Data, Law, and Ethics. Welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Thank you. Hello.
Great. So what we usually like to do is start off with some of your background. How did you get to where you are? Isaacson Professor in the School of Communication at the University of Nebraska in Omaha, blogging for HuffPo. What's up with that?
When I was young, I started out in radio and radio journalism, radio news in Illinois and Indiana. And then I went back to school, did a PhD at Southern Illinois University in a school of journalism. So I was very journalism focused early in my career. And I came to Omaha in 1989. And it was just as things were getting very interesting with the internet. And the internet really changed my career. It really shifted me away from my early interests in radio toward what was happening online.
Great, great. So I see you online a lot because I follow you on Twitter. But maybe, and I'm just assuming here, so is it your interactions on Twitter and various other social media sites like LinkedIn or Facebook that drove you to write this book?
Well, I think, you know, I was working a lot on the web in the 1990s as this was developing, and our students were becoming very interested in the topic. We have a master's program in communication here at UNO, and so I was advising some theses that cut into these issues. So I had an interest. And then I think when things really began to change for me was in about 2009. I had joined Twitter the year before, but I hadn't done a lot with Twitter in that first year. Mainly it was a lot of tech-oriented people here in the Omaha community that were interacting. And we have an event here called Big Omaha that draws people in to kind of look at venture capital and startups and that kind of thing. And in that same year, in 2009, I attended Edelman PR's academic summit, and they now do these about every 2 years. But in 2009, it was very interesting because Twitter was very active with an uprising in Iran at the time, and I began to realize that something important was happening that hadn't happened before with a lot of this media and technology. And the following year, in 2010, we held a conference here on campus called Omaha 10-10-10. And at Omaha 10-10-10, we brought people to campus from across the country physically, but also virtually. We used video conferencing software as well. And we formed a social media team. We have a strong public relations firm, student-run firm here. And so they formed a social media plan. And we had probably 400 people attend our 3 days of events on campus. Mm-hmm. When we went back and looked at the analytics for the event, the reach was about 96,000 across the world.
Wow.
Who had in some way or another encountered our content on Twitter. And so the light bulbs for me at that point really started going off in terms of the influence that is spread through social media, the amplification of messages, the importance of trust and engagement, and a lot of the issues that I cover in the book.
Yeah. No, you mentioned the terms influence, trust, and engagement. And in part of your book, you said influence and trust are key concepts for social media. And I was wondering, okay, well, first of all, what do you mean by that? But secondly, is that different now for communications professions than perhaps it was prior to perhaps the explosion in use of social media, but also just, you know, the use of the web in general?
I think it is. You know, one of the things that we kick around a lot in just casual conversations is, how would have 9/11 been different if Twitter and Facebook and Instagram had been where they are now? You know, how would that have changed or altered the conversation? We had a mall shooting here several years ago, just right before these social media tools took off. And the same kind of thing, some of this communication was happening in text messages, but it wasn't so public as it is in a place like Twitter. So I think when communication becomes as public as it has become, and when privacy is altered because of this, it does change the nature of the communication. I think the other thing that you alluded to that is important is, early on, a lot of the emphasis in the 1990s and even pre-Twitter had to do with what we would call academically computer-mediated communication. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the killer app, the original killer app, was email. And how did email, you know, affect people in different ways? And what were the issues with the richness or lack of richness in communication when you didn't see somebody face-to-face, for example? And, you know, we talk about there things like identity, interaction, community, and how we study those areas. And those remain important, but I think what has changed in recent years is that previous professional definitions, those old silos of journalism, public relations, advertising, marketing, etc., have all begun to blend and overlap in ways that are very interesting.
Mm-hmm. I was, you know, one of my questions I had for you is, have the professions been redefined? I mean, because if we think about it, on Twitter, for example, a lot of the journalists are using Twitter to engage the audience, right? Tweeting out their story links or links to their stories and just comments on various things that are happening right now or currently. And you think about it, but that used to be kind of a job for a public relations person, right? Or a community relations person to do that kind of activity. So I'm wondering about the blurring of the lines, the redefining of the profession, and how actually as a professor in a communication school, what that means for you in teaching students about this.
Absolutely, it's changed. I think, I mean, I came out of an era in the 1980s when I was a radio news director where anything that crossed the line over into advertising or PR or marketing was frowned upon, right?
Right.
So we're very much past that place with the profession of journalism. And, you know, to the point where not only are journalists encouraged to drive traffic to their websites, what I think is coming around the corner is what some people have talked about at places like Forbes, where there's an emphasis now on native advertising, is that journalists might even be paid not with a standard check, but based on the performance of the content that they generate. So that's a very different game to play, in a sense. So you have all of those factors going on. And then, you know, some of the things that I've talked about in the book are, you know, what do you do about live tweeting as an event is unfolding? And we saw that recently with the shootings in the St. Louis area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the inability in some cases to verify information, the challenges related to that, and the fact that when events such as this unfold, people with political agendas will engage in the conversation and try to influence the conversation through what we would have traditionally called propaganda, mm-hmm. If not persuasion. And so I think all of that has an impact on journalism because it is more of a commercial pressure. And I think even in the training, the lines are blurred. Even in the classroom, we are crossing those traditional boundaries, and students are less likely to be in an isolated public relations class, for example. They're more likely to be interacting throughout a curriculum with people who plan to go and work in newspapers or television news or radio news.
Sure.
And then you throw marketing into the mix, and it's sort of a free-for-all because marketing is the largest of these industries in terms of revenues, but it's also the most diverse in terms of the best practices versus things that we might conclude are unethical behavior. And there's a wide spectrum there. So I think it challenges everybody in this competitive marketplace to do the right thing, to have good business practices, but also be successful.
Mm-hmm. So convergence is no longer just print and audio or video. It's convergence is the money and the editorial mixing together, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, you throw on top of this, everything since the fall of 2008 has been influenced by some rather severe economic pressures, mm-hmm. and downsizing in many of these workforces and new growth industries emerging from that. And so the industries look quite different than they did before all of this.
Now, we're talking about how social media has influenced the change in media and also education for students going into those various professions. How has social media changed communication behavior?
Communication behavior?
Yes.
Well, it's an interesting question that you ask. I just happened to be on another campus over the weekend, and I don't normally spend much time in dorms, but I happened to find myself on a dorm floor with a friend of our son, and we talked about this a little bit, that, you know, the generation growing up is always connected now. Mm-hmm. Whether it's through Facebook or Instagram or Snapchat or whatever the case might be, it's different than when you and I were potentially experiencing that part of our lives. And so, I mean, I think what's different is that people don't handle silence well. They don't handle downtime and times for reflection very well. And I think that has an impact on face-to-face communication. And, you know, it's the old item that a lot of people have already talked about, which is when you go out to dinner, can everybody leave their phones in their pockets and purses long enough to have a nice dinner and a nice conversation? It's really difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So with the influx of all this information from various sources, from your mobile phone, from, you know, televisions in various different places and sounds and sites, but particularly from social media, how are you finding, or in your research, people able to sort through all of the mass of information to get to either the stuff that they find has the most integrity or that is just basically true? How are people doing that, and how well are they doing in that?
Well, I think in many cases, the software applications are beginning to do this for us because we haven't done it very well. Mm-hmm. And although Facebook has taken some criticism for filtering messages on the news feed, the fact probably remains for a lot of people, if they saw every single post on their news feed, they'd be overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. Because of the amount of it. Even with the filtering, I get overwhelmed with the amount of posts, particularly on a weekend where something is going on. So I think that's happening at that level. I've been looking at mobile radio news recently and have a blog post in the works on this. You know, in that industry, the apps are working to learn from what we like and also doing some filtering that leads us to not see the same stories or hear the same stories again, but also to learn our preferences, our interests. And that there might be a good aspect to that. And like everything on the internet, it's paradoxical. The bad side is that we may, in the long run, have less common civic knowledge as a public. And so, you know, if we're filtering based on who we are, you know, how do we cross those bridges and talk to each other, talk to people who are different than us if we're seeing different media content? I think that's the bigger long-term issue that is yet to be addressed. And you know, you see that with what happened in Ferguson, where the polling data still shows, for example, the racial divides across the country.
Sure.
On how people see essentially the same event. They see it quite differently. So I think that's a worry long term, is that we lose cohesion because of this. You know, the hope going into computer mediated communication in the 1990s was that we would build these online communities and we'd strengthen our sense of commonality with our fellow people. But if all we do is sort of go off into a corner with people who think like us, that maybe doesn't advance us as a society much.
Sure. Now, you're starting to talk about something I wanted to ask you about as well with respect to the book, and that is theory, right? Our theories that we associate with technology, with communication and information, and you do have a whole chapter on theories, so uses and gratifications, diffusion of information, all these other theories. How are you seeing those theories actually play out on social media and the various social media? So obviously Facebook is different from Twitter, or at least for right now it is, although Twitter is creeping towards Facebook a lot, but it's different from G+ and different from LinkedIn. How are those different theories playing themselves out on this new media?
Well, theory is important. Academics like to rely upon theory. But for a variety of reasons, but it clarifies our definitions.
Sure.
Of the concepts. So it clarifies what we're talking about. But the thing that theory does when it's helpful is that it gives us a longer term view of what we're observing. So we're making these observations, and if we make them without theory, in the absence of theory, it's really difficult to interpret what we're seeing. We can conjecture about that, but the theory really gives us direction to interpret and you know, ultimately move beyond description to predicting where the social world is headed and what we can expect there. So, yeah, I have looked at some theories, and certain theories. I remember as a graduate student in the 1980s, the late 1980s, there were theories that were almost dying on the vine that have really had a resurgence because of social media. I mean, diffusion had been around for a long time when social media came along. But, you know, it gives us a sense of how people adopt new technologies, and then from that, how people adopt new ideas, and that there is a pattern to this adoption, and that it allows us to do things like compare what's happening between face-to-face communication and other mediated forms of communication and the impact of that. Going way, way back, the communication discipline, you know, had something called the two-step flow of communication, later the multi-step flow of communication. But if you go back to the 1950s and that research, it was really about influence, as we were talking about earlier. It was really about how personal influence and persuasion function in a society. Mm-hmm. Originally, those studies were based on a geographic community. But what online has done is created these online communities where influence and communication is exchanged. And so you see an event that unfolds, and interpretation of that event might be rather ambiguous about how to discern what you're seeing and hearing. Mm-hmm. And you might look to trusted sources, people who you've talked to before, to see what they're saying. So those opinion leaders are still important, but they tend to be online, influencing much larger groups of people. What I think is really fundamentally different in the social media era is that in the traditional media era, you know, you had your personal social network of friends and family, social groups in your community. And then you had the media stars out there, the people that the country looked to, the politicians, the celebrities, those type of folk as opinion leaders. Now, anybody with a following on Twitter can exercise that influence. And so the gatekeeping is much weaker than it was in the traditional media era. And so it does open the landscape to a broader range of influencers, I think. It extends our sphere of influence potentially to a much wider group of people. But it does run the risk of kind of filtering out the people who don't think like us. And so in that way, it is both broadening and narrowing. So, you know, I come back to that word paradox, which I played with in a book I did many years ago called Free Expression in the Age of the Internet, mm-hmm. where we were already talking about these concepts.
Now, you talked about the idea of gatekeeping, which is a traditional, you know, you'll hear it in every mass comm theory course that you get. Is gatekeeping no longer a function of the, you know, people think of gatekeepers as the institutional press. Are people now on their own with the gatekeeping? I know we talked about just a second ago about filtering with, you know, some of the platforms, Facebook, Twitter now, opening the floodgates with putting people on your timeline that you're not following anymore, right? So is gatekeeping now the purview of, say, regular people and not institutions?
Well, you know, it depends what your feed looks like. I've followed at sometimes over 2,000 accounts on Twitter. I'm back under 2,000, I think. But you know, after Ferguson, I think I'm close to 2,000 again. I've always seen tweets from people I follow retweeting something. Mm-hmm. So they've been on the feed for a long time. But yeah, I do think that, you know, Facebook wants to grow, Twitter wants to grow, and so they're always suggesting people that you might follow. At the same time, there really is a limit to what you can follow and who you can follow, and before the feed becomes unmanageable. And I mean, that's why Facebook's answer is to filter pretty severely back down to what they think you want. Mm-hmm. So theirs is a study of, we think we know what Jeremy wants to see, and we'll try to give him that. Twitter is still sort of at the phase of trying to encourage people to add follows. But some of us already follow too many people, I think. So it's a challenge. I do think you have to curate your feed as a user and really think about whether something is noise or signal. Right. And that takes us back to traditional communication theory too, right, which was kind of schematic engineering signal-to-noise ratio. As the noise increases, the signal gets lost in that noise, and that's what happens on a Twitter feed when things are very active. But these applications don't make it as easy to go through and, you know, unfollow as it is to just click that follow button. So you really have to either use some software that helps you do that, or you got to spend some time managing your feed. But it's one of those things that I think is, we haven't really developed great norms, social norms that help us with how to go about this. And there's a lot of trial and error, I find. I don't know if you find that as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, one of the things you say in the book is that social media involves human storytelling. So I was wondering if you could just discuss that. And does that make social media any different from traditional media? Or does that, one of the things that makes it at least good social media and good traditional media or influential or persuasive media, is that what makes it very similar to every kind of old media?
I think so. We've been engaged here on my campus for the last 5 years in a rather dramatic, significant curriculum revision to try to respond to everything that's happening and rework our academic programs in journalism and public relations and advertising. And as we had guests on campus who were experts in digital and social, and as we held hour after hour of faculty meetings to debate and discuss these issues, we kept coming back to the idea of storytelling as foundational, as fundamental to what we do in communication. And what that led us to do in our curriculum was we created two media storytelling classes that everybody has to take, mm-hmm. Storytelling 1 and Storytelling 2, and they come after our introductory courses and after our first writing course, because we really came to understand that for our students to go out and have successful internships and be successful as professionals, they're going to have to be great storytellers. And so in that regard, yeah, nothing has changed from 25 years ago when I became a professor. That was true then. Mm-hmm. But in another sense, I think it has changed because of the nature of storytelling itself. I mean, you look at a site such as Upworthy and the way that they, you know, manage headlines and, you know, what some people call clickbait, the way that we are storytelling within some of these sites has changed and continues to evolve. You know, something becomes popular and everybody does it, right? Mm-hmm. So you had the ice bucket challenge, right, is a good example of something going viral and everybody is jumping on board, right? And if you don't, you feel like, gosh, maybe I should have or something. So, you know, in a sense, there's a lot of peer pressure that comes to bear in social media when it's effective in this way. So I do think storytelling is an important element. A friend of mine who manages a media monitoring company, he's mentioned in the book, Todd Murphy, has a hashtag that he's used sometimes on Twitter that's called Same Rules, New Tools. Mm. And we had a debate about this over the course of several years because, you know, he was convinced that the rules haven't changed at all and that really all that's changed is the media platforms. And I kept saying, I'm not so sure, Todd. Let's see how this plays out. And it's clear that some of the storytelling rules hold. The parts of a story, a narrative, the way a story is told still hold today. But I do think that, you know, because of the way that content spreads across the social net, some of the rules have changed about that as well. I mean, certainly, I mean, we've known this before social media. From when I first went to graduate school, the average length of a soundbite on television news was about 43 seconds. The last time I heard a research study on it, it was about 6 seconds. Mm. So, you know, people want things fast. They don't want to spend a lot of time on it. And so stories are told, you know, with brevity, with conciseness. They have to attract attention in this noisy social environment.
Right, so the length of a vine is about all.
Yeah, so that 6 seconds seems to be what people are angling toward. And so I think there is a worry there, and it does have an impact on what the rules are, because, you know, there's no way that you can be as coherent and as thoughtful in 6 seconds as we can in a half-hour interview, right?
Sure. Sure.
You know, the context is altered. And so things get decontextualized oftentimes. And that can lead to confusion. That can lead to people jumping prematurely to conclusions. So those are problems with the storytelling.
You know, one of the quotes that you had at the beginning of one of the chapters in your book was from someone that said that Twitter, and I'm sure this goes to almost every social media where you post a status or something like that, that Twitter is basically a visualization of our inner selves, right? So I wanted to ask you about relationship formation and the importance of relationship formation that we see or visualize using social media, and the importance of that social media has been for relationship formation that's important for the various professions that you discuss in the book. So you have journalism, you have advertising, PR, and marketing. So you visualize those different relationships that students, you know, they hear about that are important, but now they actually get to see them in action.
Right. Yeah, and we've just launched in May the UNO Social Media Lab and our brand new Community Engagement Center, we're working with nonprofits who have a lot of interest in having their social networks connected in a stronger way. And so the visualization is an important piece to this. We've been working with a variety of social media measurement platforms, but one that relates to your question, I think, quite clearly is an open source project called NodeXL. Mm-hmm. And the Social Media Research Foundation and Mark Smith have done some really interesting work in this area. And, you know, it does create a visualization of what a social network looks like on a Twitter conversation. And I think one way to think about it in a visual sense is, so we're having this conversation and it's back and forth. If we were doing it on Twitter, in a sense, we're coming closer together in social space. Mm-hmm. But what's different in social media is that people around us are watching this conversation unfold. Everything is very public.
Right.
And so there might be a crowd that gathers around this conversation. It's as if we were out on the sidewalk downtown having a very, you know, extensive, elaborate conversation about an important social issue, and people start to engage with us. People want to be part of that conversation. Well, we can visualize that with these social networks and look at the inclusion or exclusion of people within that network. The degree to which it is, you know, really comprised of public and or private people, the interests of those people, the places that they work, the content that they tweet in a given day, the links that they send people to. All of those things, I think, are important elements that we learn from looking at those visualizations because they are very public and available. But I do think it does feed back, going back to theory, it feeds back into our deeper understanding of what a social network really is about. And this there's some theory related to social network analysis that dates back decades as well,
right.
You know, that started in places like, you know, what happens in a classroom when we put a group of five students together and another group over here of four students, you know, what does that conversation look like?
Right.
Well, you know, we can sort of see this also unfold, you know, in a social media setting as well. And so the fact that it is public and it is something that we can visualize lends some ability to begin to understand what's really going on in these conversations. And, you know, what we can learn from a communication perspective when it goes well and it's productive,
mm-hmm.
And at the same time when people are flaming each other and it's very destructive to social unity, what's happening there? Who are the agitators of that conversation? What photographs or other rich media, you know, generate that spark? And so I think you're going to see a lot more interest in this going forward.
Mm-hmm. So the book is Social Media Communication, Concepts, Practices, Data, Law, and Ethics. What do you hope that your readers take away from the book?
If you step back and you look at kind of what's the larger argument behind this book, I think you've tapped into it in some of your earlier questions. I'm making an argument that what I have labeled social media communication is a distinct form of communication that both is informed by our earlier understanding of communication, theory, methods, observations, and the like practices, but it also is distinct in its own way. And going forward, we have to give special attention to it as a different form of communication. A really good example, I think, is when we talk to students, and I talked to some incoming students this summer that were in orientation about, you know, how they handle their personal brand,
mm-hmm.
And what they're doing in social media and what employers are looking at when they interview you later for an internship or a job, and how that can knock you out of the job you want if the way you're presenting yourself in social media is quite different from the way you try to present yourself in an interview. that people then do have a trust issue, for example. They say, well, I might not care about that post on social media, but if it looks like this person is really presenting themselves quite differently in this interview, then I start to wonder what else is different that I don't know about, and they don't want to hire that person. Mm-hmm. So we talk about personal brand and the data that are out there, such as even the location of a tweet if they don't set their privacy setting, and you know, who they're interacting with and those kinds of things. And so it is a special form of communication that requires a new set of practices that professionals need to use, but also really every consumer should know these things about social media, because you know, as you notice at the end of the book, we get to, you know, what are the legal cases that are popping up because when it goes wrong, basically,
right?
What are the ethical concerns that we should all have as communicators? And then what about media literacy? What should we know that we might not know when we operate in these spaces? Because, you know, one of the strategies you might be tempted to exercise, well, I'm just not going to go on social media. I'm not going to have any of these accounts. I'm going to not do any of it because it's too dangerous. There's all these problems with it. But then you really isolate yourself from this vibrant conversation. So, you know, is there a way to understand, to become literate in a social media sense, and then develop practices that put you in a better place. And it's not always easy. We were working on a story that's going to be in our local media this afternoon at 5 o'clock on one of our TV stations. There's a young woman who is trying to become a model. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she put a profile photo on Facebook, which, you know, profile and cover photos remain public because of the Facebook terms of service. And somebody has lifted that photo and is using it in an advertisement. She doesn't even know who this person is. And Facebook won't tell her, who it is. She went to Facebook and said, they shouldn't, you know, can you take that down? And they said, no, we won't do that. These are our terms of service. She went to the local police department and they said, there's nothing criminal here. We can't deal with it. You might file a civil suit, you know, and so it becomes very difficult sometimes, you know, for people to respond to what's happening in these spaces. And it's not always ethical practices. In fact, a lot of times it's not what we would, you know, looking at codes of ethics for professionals, like PR professionals, we would say that's not, you know, really an ethical best practice. We might even look at the law and say, you know, in most settings, using somebody's image, that they have a legal right to protect the commercial purposes of that. But what's happened, you know, beginning with the internet and now even extending with social media, is that these old rules are being eroded. Mm-hmm. They're being blurred. And, you know, none of this has been going on long enough that we're getting enough case law to really begin to define what are the new rules, you know, at a legal, ethical sense. You know, people are in the middle of developing these social media policies that I talk about in the book. Mm-hmm. And that also is very much in play. I just saw an item the other day that at Northern Illinois University, undergraduates who are logging on from their dorms all of a sudden get a pop-up that says, you know, this might have crossed our, you know, boundaries of, you know, offensiveness, what you're about to look at, and go ahead, but we monitor these things and there could be, you know, ramifications. So there's kind of a chilling effect there if you see sure. something like that pop up on your screen. But it's a very challenging time, I think, for organizations to determine, you know, how much guidance, what is the appropriate amount of guidance students, employees, others should be given, how much we need formal policy or not. And then, you know, what happens when it's somebody's, formal job responsibility, for example, be a social media site manager, and it's their job to be in these spaces. How do we create policies that work for them without severely restricting our desire to maintain a value in free speech, free expression, mm-hmm. Maintaining the values of the First Amendment that we have in this country. So, you know, from an academic standpoint, it's a great time to be studying these issues. It makes our conversations, our discussion in class very electric.
Sure.
Because students understand the stakes, I think, when we begin to explain these things. And it's, you know, we cover history, but we bring it forward to, you know, what's happening now and why going forward in your life and your career, this is going to be important. Mm-hmm.
So what's next for you? So you have this book, you just published it. It's out now, available on Amazon, from the publisher, everywhere. What's next for you?
Well, in the short term, I have computer-mediated communication class tomorrow and social media metrics on Thursday. Mm-hmm. We've got a measurement week coming up in September that we are coordinating. So we're focusing the community on, you know, kind of the future of measurement and social media and what the issues are and why they should be interested in it. And, you know, there's been some attention with the NSA story and all of that to concerns about big data and privacy. And so we want to talk about those things. But in the research sense, this book left me wanting to do much more in the area of disclosure. Mm-hmm. And the regulatory body in our country that has tried to address this is the Federal Trade Commission. But it happens kind of at the guidelines level. And there's, you know, it's not a very well-formed set of practices, if you will, but it's some guidelines. And there are some very significant issues with disclosure in social media. I attended, while I was researching this book last fall and I was on leave, I attended Social Media Week events in Chicago, and there was a particular panel organized by Professor David Kamer at Loyola mm-hmm. University in Chicago with professionals addressing this issue. And I became very interested. I touch on some of these things in this book, but I think there's much more that needs to be talked about there and researched. And so I'm beginning to really closely examine, for example, celebrities. Celebrities and celebrity endorsement. There's a real problem out there right now with celebrities making thousands of dollars for tweeting an endorsement that they have a financial interest in and not disclosing that. Mm-hmm. I think that's a real serious issue going forward. People tweeting about interests of their clients, so they're getting paid to represent someone, but it's not very clear from the social media communication that they have this relationship. So I think, you know, coming back to what we talked about at the beginning of this interview, trust, you know, we have to have some rules of the road for how that happens and how we come to trust this broader array of communicators than we had in the more the era of gatekeeping when our media did some of that vetting for us.
Great. That sounds very interesting. We'll be looking forward to reading more from you. So the book is Social Media Communication, Concepts, Practices, Data, Law, and Ethics. People go out and get the book, read it. And we thank Professor Lipschultz for being on the show today.
Thank you very much. It's been a terrific conversation. Enjoyed doing it.
All right. So this has been New Books in Technology. And thank you and have a good week.